of Christmases Long, Long Ago is my new book, arriving for the 2025 Christmas season. Find out what Christmas was like centuries ago. Sneak preview, it was weird, and spooky, and rowdy, kind of gross sometimes. Find it wherever books are sold, in hardcover from Lions Press, and audiobook from Recorded Books. It's Christmas as you've never seen it before, and it makes a great gift. I'm Brian Earle. This is Christmas Past. It was the week before Christmas in 1917 when a young man named Walter in Halifax, Nova Scotia, sat down to write a letter to his pen pal Harold in Stoughton, Massachusetts. How and why they came to be pen pals is lost to history, but it wouldn't have been unusual. The Maritime Provinces and New England, or the Boston States as many Maritimers once called them, had long been tied by shared waters, migration, and trade. Boston and Halifax in particular, each a harbor city facing the Atlantic, each a colonial outpost turned cornerstone of its nation's story. Despite the date on the calendar, Walter's letter wasn't to wish Harold the greetings of the season. It was to tell him what had happened. Canada had entered the Great War 3 years prior. America had just entered it that spring. And Halifax, though separated from the trenches by an ocean, had experienced a catastrophe of such scale that even the farthest corners of the world would take notice. Walter's letter spoke of a city shaken to its foundation, of lives lost and homes leveled, of a harbor town reduced in minutes to ash and memory. But it also spoke of a friendship, of the city that came to Halifax's aid, of one Bostonian who, in Walter's words, became the hero of dear old Halifax. During the war, Halifax had become a vital artery of the Allied war effort, a port where convoys gathered to cross the Atlantic, loaded with troops, supplies, and munitions. The city's population swelled by 10,000, brimming with sailors and soldiers, rail workers and dockhands. Ammunition trains thundered in and troop ships rolled out. There were telegrams, sirens, steel wheels, and ship horns. But on the morning of December 6th, the mood was more domestic than martial. It was a Wednesday and Christmas was just around the corner. Children were buttoning their coats for school, shopkeepers unlocking their doors. With so many servicemen in town, there was more business than usual. Two ships were using the harbor that morning. One was the SS Emo, a merchant steamship that had just delivered coal for the Belgian Relief Commission and was now on its way to New York to pick up grain. The other was the SS Mont Blanc, a French ship carrying explosives bound for the front. It had come up from New York to join a convoy forming in Halifax. Normally, a ship like the Mont Blanc would fly a red flag, a warning to all in the harbor that it had explosives on board. But it was wartime and some rules had to bend. A flag like that would only be a beacon for spies. So the Mont Blanc slipped into Halifax Harbor quietly that morning, hiding in plain sight. A floating bomb packed with picric acid, benzol, gun cotton, and TNT. The Emo, leaving the harbor, had been forced to veer off course to avoid a steamer coming up on the wrong side. Then a tugboat. By the time it cleared those obstacles, the Emo was facing down the Mont Blanc. Their whistles blared, each ship signaling its right of way. The accident wasn't even that bad. The two ships were traveling at barely a mile an hour when they collided. But that was enough to topple and spill the barrels of benzol on the Mont Blanc's deck. Vapors rose, invisible but deadly. And as the Emo disengaged from the collision, it caused a spark. The Mont Blanc caught fire. And because the ship's fire hose had been ironically destroyed in the fire, the captain knew that the only thing to do now was to order the crew to abandon ship. Hundreds of people by now had gathered at windows or in the streets to watch. And watching this spectacular fire, rising from a ship that flew no red flag, they didn't fully understand what they were seeing, and didn't hear or didn't understand the crew of the Mont Blanc as they frantically tried to wave people away to safety. Had no way of knowing that as the seconds ticked past, the fire was growing closer to the nearly 3,000 metric tons of high explosives on board. At 9:04 a.m., the Mont Blanc exploded. The blast flattened nearly everything within a mile and a half. The pressure wave from the blast, traveling faster than the speed of sound, snapped trees, bent iron, and hurled ships from the water like toys. The harbor floor was momentarily exposed. Then came the surge, a wave 60 feet high crashing against a city already in ruins. Windows shattered, turning glass into shrapnel that blinded hundreds. Lamps and stoves overturned. Homes caught fire. Fragments of the Mont Blanc were hurled miles away. A half-ton piece of anchor landed more than 2 miles from the harbor. It was the largest man-made explosion in history at the time, and it would remain so until the invention of nuclear weapons decades later. 1,600 lives were lost that day. 9,000 more were wounded. A quarter of the city left homeless in the thick Canadian winter. And as if by cruel punctuation, a blizzard arrived that night. Fire brigades came from as far as Truro and Amherst. Some arrived only to discover that their hoses didn't fit Halifax's hydrants. Chaos reigned, but so did kindness. Nurses tore sheets into bandages. Neighbors lifted rubble by hand. Horse-drawn laundry sleighs became ambulances. Word reached Boston almost immediately. Massachusetts Governor Samuel McCall activated the Massachusetts Committee on Public Safety, a wartime effort spun up just months earlier. That night, a relief train was assembled. 2 dozen doctors, nurses, Red Cross volunteers, and medical supplies. And leading them was Abraham Reshetsky, a son of Jewish immigrants who had served in both city and state government. He co-founded Beth Israel Hospital and was part of the responders to the Great Chelsea Fire and the Great Salem Fire. And now he was bound for Halifax. The trip was harrowing. In a report to Governor McCall, Reshetsky described the journey.
At St. John, we encountered a heavy storm, one of the most severe of the winter, accompanied by a gale of terrible velocity. The snow was piling up and progress was difficult. We lost considerable time between St. John and Moncton. At this point, to ensure getting through to Halifax, a large freight engine was attached to the train. Beyond Truro and Moncton, the storm increased and was a veritable blizzard. We were also delayed several hours while our engine, which had broken down, was repaired. The climax was reached when we came up to Folly Mountain, and the conductor in charge, C.H. Truman, accompanied by C.K. Howard, General Agent, Canadian Government Railways, stated that, as an enormous snowdrift lay across the track, it was impossible to proceed farther. I then showed them the telegram from the official of the railroad in which orders were given for the right-of-way to the special train. I pleaded with them to do everything in their power known to railroad men to clear the track. Under general conditions, no attempt would have been made to keep the train moving, but the need was tremendously urgent. The men, realizing this and knowing that every moment was precious, worked like Trojans. Within an hour, by hard shoveling, the use of steam and ramming, and amid great cheers from all on board, we went through the drift, which extended higher than the door of the baggage car. We succeeded in reaching Truro, and found another engine and crew waiting for the final haul to Halifax.
And when they arrived, the work began. Surgery by lamplight, shelters built, makeshift infirmaries and morgues. Reshetsky coordinated efforts with precision and compassion, organizing ad hoc committees, rebuilding networks, and modernizing disaster response as he went. Halifax survived and began to heal. A year later, in 1918, to show their gratitude, Halifax presented Boston with a magnificent Christmas tree, which was displayed on the Boston Common. Because, after all, what kind of gift do you give to a city that helped save your life? A city that rushed to your side before the snow had even settled? A city that didn't wait to be asked? Not a payment, because there's no settling a debt like that. Not a favor returned, because no favor was ever asked. Just a tree. A tall, proud evergreen from the forests of Nova Scotia. Its branches full and fragrant. its needles sharp as memory, something verdant when all else had been scorched. Decades later, in 1971, that gift became an annual tradition. Now, every year, the people of Nova Scotia send a Christmas tree to the people of Boston. With due ceremony, it's driven south through Canada, Maine, and New Hampshire, and placed on the Boston Common, where it stands lit throughout the season. And when the lights flicker on each December, they shine on a story of grief and grace, of a harbor lit by fire and a friendship lit by kindness. They shine on the best that two cities can be in the worst of times. They shine on a tree and on everything it means. Growing up in the Boston area, I always had a vague awareness of this story. Something about a Christmas tree given to Boston because we helped after an explosion. But only after researching the story for this episode did I really come to appreciate the gravity of it all. To this day, a large public clock in Halifax remains frozen to the time of the explosion on that morning more than a century ago. I was also surprised to find out that my hometown of Stoughton, Massachusetts plays some small role in the telling of this story. Check the show notes to this episode for a link to where you can read that full letter that Walter wrote to Harold. And by the time you hear this story, of course, Boston's Christmas tree will be lighting up the Boston Common. I have lots of memories of going to see it when I lived in the city. Speaking of memories, how about some of yours? I'll be sharing your Christmas memories this season in special episodes dedicated just to them. There's still time to send one, even though Christmas is now less than 2 weeks away. All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Thank you to Carl Sjoberg for narrating that passage of Reshetsky's report to Governor McCall. And as always, thank you for listening. I hope you're having a wonderful Christmas season and that the best is yet to come. You can drop me a line anytime to tell me about your season, to say hi, to share a Christmas memory, anything. I love to hear from you and I try my best to respond to every message I get. You can send me an email or look for Christmas Past on your favorite social media platform. If you don't see me there and you think I should be, get in touch and let me know. And hey, if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover this show? It's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a rating and review. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker and a handwritten Christmas card as my way of saying thanks. Reach out for details. And until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.